You're listening to the Musical Ecologies Radio Hour. I'm your host, Dan Joseph, and once a month we bring you a mix of conversations and musical selections by artists featured on the Musical Ecologies series in Park Slope, Brooklyn. I invite you to visit our website for more information on our artists and upcoming events at musicalecologies.net. For tonight's program, we'll revisit our event on January 21st with New York-based electronic artist Lori Napoleon. Widely regarded for her eclectic DJ sets and modular synthesizer-based soundscapes, Napoleon performs under various pseudonyms, and tonight she appeared as Antennas. We discussed her different musical identities and various aspects of her work during our extended conversation that started the evening, and later she performed a new electronic set that she's currently developing for her appearance later this year at Moogfest. But we'll begin tonight's program with my conversation with Lori Napoleon at the Old Stone House in Park Slope, Brooklyn. And tonight we're happy to have Lori Napoleon joining us. Welcome, Lori.
Thanks.
And Lori Napoleon, aka Antennas, tonight. So you know, maybe that's a good place to start. I want to understand a little bit more about this alias and maybe your other aliases and just the idea of an alias in general. Maybe you could speak to that.
Well, the alias that I started using initially was Meridian 7, right. And I still use that for sound installations that are directly related to telecommunications history. Mm-hmm. The name Meridian 7 is a reference to the time service operator that you would call in the old days to get the accurate times. Uh-huh. So and that you would call and they would take hour-long shifts and say, when you hear the signal, the time will be 5:45, beep.
Right.
So you would dial 6371212. So mm-hmm. The meridian was the term for ME, because right. When telephone numbers were invented, people didn't think that it would be able to be remembered, like the entire number. They put names.
Right, right. Well, and they also used neighborhoods and so on to refer to the beginnings of phone numbers as well, right?
Right, so it was the name of the local exchange.
The local exchange.
The local exchange where you would go for to talk to an operator, and then later they might patch your call to long distance. Mm-hmm. So, for example, my grandma's number was Skyline 57236. So mm-hmm. The SK was the 75. But as I started to work on production more and more, I felt that I wanted to have an alias or project name that was a little bit more open to different types of content, because some work I do is really directly about telecommunications mm-hmm. and about different stories that I read, for example, storms and how they affected the switchboards and the different sonic artifacts that would happen. Mm-hmm. But other times I'll just do music that's about myself or about mm-hmm. Something else that I noticed in the now. Mm-hmm. So I chose Antennas because I feel like the word antenna encapsulates a kind of wonder that traverses a lot of the things that I've been interested in,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
just that there's signals passing through the air all the time and you use them to tune into one thing or another. It's mm-hmm. a particular fascination.
Right, right. So tuning things in. So this Antennas alias or moniker is it's just the more encompassing one. It doesn't mm-hmm. so the work that you do under this name doesn't necessarily have to involve telephones or telecommunications or otherwise, whereas Meridian 7 is, I guess, always involved in some way with that world.
Yes, when I did the last performance I did, well, it was actually an installation of 5.1 surround at Harvest Works,
mm-hmm.
and it was a collage of my sounds with archival reel-to-reel footage of the Phone Phreaks from the 70s. So mm-hmm. it was all related to hidden sounds or the silences that they would go into the payphones and purposely record so that they could find rare phenomena, mm-hmm. rare sonic phenomena, such as what does it sound like when you call an office with 50 phone lines and they're all busy. It's a purring sound. So they would kind of look for really rare and unusual telecom related phenomena. So archives of that is really interesting. Mm-hmm. So since that was more like an audio museum to me, I used that name.
I see. So let's touch on the the Phone Phreaks a little bit. So this, as I understand it, that refers to some sort of small subculture of aficionados of the telephone network who were able to figure out different ways to interact with the system in ways that maybe weren't intended, right? To make whistling tones or different kind of pitches that would simulate the way that the system actually works and thereby create situations. Is that basically?
Yes, absolutely.
It?
And because I started building synthesizers into telephone switchboards, I decided to just do a little bit more research on the context. And so the people who call themselves Phone Phreaks, they're similar in a way to the ham radio community, where mm-hmm. they found hidden channels with which to communicate with each other. A lot of the Phone Phreaks were actually blind, and they, for example, one of them had perfect pitch and was just playing with the phone because his siblings were out, you know, doing, you know, things that sighted people do, going out and interacting with people.
Right.
And so the blind community found a way to create their own community, you know, their own sound world by, for example, figuring out a certain number and code to press, and you hang up the phone, and then the phone would do a special ring, and you'd call it back, and that was a lineman's test line.
Mm-hmm.
And they would do conference calls with each other and organize meetings and exchange information and play games such as how many tandem stacking. This is the term for how many links can you accomplish, of how many different cities can you connect to in order to call somebody, like what's the longest, how many countries, and then what kind of echo is a result of that, you know. So they would call their friend, and if there was a 2-second echo, that would be impressive, and then when they'd hang up, it would create this kind of surround sound, clicking, purring noise of all of the relays around the whole world closing off. So in a way, it was also kind of a seeking distance, you know, seeking of connection with people at a great distance,
right,
just from your home, you know, 13-year-old, 14-year-olds, just connecting to the whole world that way.
Right.
I'm also just really interested in the ambient sounds. If you read about Phone Phreaks, one of the first things that comes up is pranking, you know, that they figured out that the Captain Crunch whistle, if you whistle it into the phone, it's actually at 2600 hertz signal, which is a tone that that the relays at the time interpreted as you hung up, and therefore you could dial a long distance call for free.
Right.
Or they figured out ways to do this.
Yeah.
But besides that, I mean, some of the archival footage that I came across was, I mean, it was about free calls, but at the same time, they were very poetic. They would kind of call this, for example, the silences of Long Island, where they would purposely take as long of a time as they could between dialing numbers, because they could hear and find relevant information in the specific times of drones or whirs of an adjacent cable oscillating that wasn't in use.
Mm.
So what they would say very poetic things like, you know, you're connected to the network, so even if you're alone, you're not really, and they just loved the sounds of the electromechanical city.
Right. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So to me, I found I found that they were using the telephone lines kind of like a modular synth, mm-hmm, at a small, mm-hmm, you know, at a larger scale. They were making patches,
right,
using relays throughout the entire, mm-hmm, world, and seeing how many patches they could make and the resultant sound of it. So, mm-hmm, I just became really fascinated with that subculture.
Wow, it's, yeah, well, that's all incredibly fascinating. But I guess tell me about the archival footage. Now, what is this, and where is it, and how did you discover it? I mean, is it just, I guess, on the internet now? Everything's
on
the internet, right?
But, yep. If you just look in Phone Freaks, a couple websites come up. I can't quite remember the name of them, but there are some YouTube channels. If you just go into YouTube and type vintage telephone sounds, then, mm-hmm, you'll definitely find some that are narrated. And I think the idea of obsolete sounds or sounds that are extinct is also really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So sounds that we perhaps were used to, you know, decades ago. But this is really an extinct sound because those connections aren't really available anymore.
Right. So the phone system, I mean, I imagine, is completely different now, right? I mean, it doesn't.
Right.
It's
digital now.
It doesn't have any really.
So there was no. Yeah, you're not going to have. There's a lot more isolation of tones, so you're not going to hear all the artifacts.
Right.
But that's what they found beautiful.
Right. So taking this whole world of the telephone, the phone freaks, and all of the different patching that happens and connection that happens in the historical phone system, so that becomes a sort of a model for you in a sense of creating your own instruments, right? But also it's a kind of a sound world that informs the music that you ultimately make with
this
stuff. Absolutely. So how did you, just from a technical standpoint, how did you get from having this sort of interest in this world to converting it into an actual device that uses repurposed phone equipment? How did that happen, and how does it happen?
Oh, many years. It happened.
Right.
It started with an idea,
uh-huh,
that I wasn't necessarily looking for. I've always been involved in music in one way or another, but I don't think I really knew that I wanted to make music until I encountered modular synth and learned about sequencing and automation and the idea of sculpting sounds, mm-hmm, as opposed to necessarily using notes.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a sense that maybe I want to explore analog synthesis, and I was at ITP at NYU.
Right.
My intention there was to continue to do installation art. Also, the name Antennas relates to that because I did installations of laser beams that behaved like radio, like AM radio. So I would send sounds, amplitude modulated sounds, through a laser beam, and you would collect the sounds on the other side with a solar cell attached to a speaker. So it's basically AM radio, it's just with physical light.
Like with a very micro,
yes,
beamed frequency.
Yes. I used diffraction gratings as well, so it would kind of shower the room, and there would be just talking little beams of light, and you could walk around and play them.
Uh-huh.
So I was doing audio-visual, right, installation work, and it was just by coincidence or serendipity that I visited a small town in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan called Escanaba to celebrate a friend's engagement. And they had a lighthouse museum there that had all of the old operation systems of the town. So they had an apothecary, and they had the telegraph, some telegraph paraphernalia, and some, they had the switchboards. So I thought that was really fascinating because there was a part of my mind that was, that held a picture of the synthesizers at NYU in the back of my mind. So the Buchla, for example.
So you had already encountered the modular synthesizer world to some extent upon seeing this
I had seen
museum.
Them. I'd
right.
never used one.
Right.
But I saw it. Right. I took a class as an extra, kind of an extra two-credit class that was called Electronic Music Performance, and it was mainly laptop-based. Mm. But I just wanted to, it was my first music, like actual class that dealt with sound. Mm-hmm. And but those giant synths were sitting in the back of the room, so I had seen them.
Right, right.
And then when I saw the switchboards in Escanaba, I just kind of paired the two together, like, wow, they're so similar. I would really love to find out more about this. And there were pictures of old ads of the operators, and so seeing them operating also drew to mind, you know, pictures of Suzanne Ciani and her Buchla, or pictures of Moog, and it was just a flash of lightning.
Right.
And I dramatically changed the classes I was going to take, and I called the director and said I had to really change my focus, and I had to stay a little bit longer to do that. Mm-hmm. So
kind of reoriented your whole trajectory.
It definitely did. Huh? I had changed all the classes.
So up until that time, as you say, you were mostly so you were coming from a more of a visual arts or but where was music in your life to that time, and how did it, you know, suddenly you become a musician, or did you suddenly become a musician? Had you been a musician, or?
I was DJing, so I already had a sense of rhythm, you know, vinyl DJing, and I had played instruments, but I didn't feel particularly creative with them. So when I was in high school, I played guitar and keyboard, but I wasn't the creative force in the band. Everyone else would write the music, and I would do the rhythm guitar, the keyboard lines, and I didn't feel really like I could come up with anything new. So it was fun to be in a band, but it didn't seem like I had something really to say with it. And eventually I still had an itch to play music, so I bought a dulcimer, and I started playing that for a summer.
Which kind of dulcimer?
It was such a short, unfortunately, it only lasted a summer.
Right. But it was the lap dulcimer or the hammer
dulcimer?
It was
a hammer dulcimer.
Right, okay.
It was a summer I was attending college at University of Illinois downstate. So in Chicago during the summer, I went to the Old Town School of Folk Music and was learning how to play songs on the dulcimer. And I had this vision of, doing treated dulcimer performances like what you do.
How about that?
Quickly thereafter, I learned about a whole other genre of music, electronic music and IDM, techno, electro.
Right.
And I thought, okay, I really need this to be my musical outlet. So in addition to studying fine arts, I always had a penchant for collecting vinyl and DJing it. So
it was already going. The music thing, I mean, it wasn't just a bolt out of the blue. I mean,
you were
already pretty immersed in music, but suddenly took center stage.
It took center stage because when I was exposed to these instruments, I felt like, oh, I really could explore and say something where I never felt very creative with the other instruments.
Right.
Probably could have gone somewhere with the dulcimer, actually.
Well, you still can?
I still can, yeah. I hope.
So, okay, well, fascinating. So then how did you go about repurposing these old telephone, I don't know, what are they? I mean, there's switchboards, there's all kinds of machinery, right, that had to do with the phone system, but how did you make them into synthesizers?
Well, first you have to find them.
Right.
So At the time I had decided that my thesis and I suppose life project, because I don't have really an end in sight, is going to be switchboard synthesizers. And I wasn't sure if I was going to build a new one that was inspired by it or actually find one, because they're really quite heavy. They're giant pieces of furniture. You wouldn't want to ship one out. And so at least the first ones, because I wanted the giant patch bay, which I have in my home studio.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a pretty classic New York moment where I was just out with some friends and I mentioned the thesis idea I had, and a friend of mine said that she just had one at her house that was left there by the previous tenants, and it was just taking up space. And please just
come get it.
Come get it. So I was, wow. And they actually run a party called The Bunker.
The Bunker, sure.
Yeah, says this photographer.
For years, right?
Mm-hmm. So this was in their household.
Okay.
And I spent many hours just unscrewing and prying, taking things apart so I could load it into my car and bring it back. And there's just a lot of giant capacitors and things that I'm not really going to use. So it's interesting to kind of take the guts out of it. And what's left are a lot of Jackson plugs, you know, a lot of TRS jacks, which are very compatible with synthesizers now because the lineage is actually related to it. So that's why they look so similar and why they're called phone jacks.
So they're like patch bays, basically.
Yeah, basically lots of patch bays and various knobs. So like you see here, you hear that? Really robust.
They're solid knobs, mm-hmm. Yeah. Switches.
Yeah, so very, very playable. Built to last, mm-hmm. no planned obsolescence. They were really made to endure lots of years and years of patching.
Right. So they're basically like ready-made synthesizer components, mm-hmm. in a sense. I mean, and are you the only one who happened to discover this, or are there other people out there who spy, you know, just unbeknownst to each other, discovered this?
I've been looking to see if anyone else actually is crazy enough to do this, but I haven't. What I found that there was a professor formerly at Oberlin named Elisha Gray, and he was in a patent race with the early telephone and lost. Hmm. So he could have been known as the inventor of the telephone, but he lost to Bell by a couple days. And probably he had less business prowess, but he had an incredible knowledge about how telephones and telegraph systems work. So he ended up building some rare keyboard that's like a combination synthesizer and telegraph, which apparently is at Oberlin College somewhere. So I'll be actually visiting there in the spring. So I'm gonna try to see if I can find it.
Yeah, you're visiting as an artist residency or something.
I'll be just DJing.
DJ.
There.
Okay, great. Wow. So what have you done then? Just, I mean, you know, don't have to tell the whole story, but what basically have you been able to do with these phone patch bays or I mean, this looks like almost, is this a customized sort of
portion of a
bigger piece that you've sort of?
Yeah. At home, I have a lot of really large sequencers and synths, and I decided that it was time to start building performance instruments that I could bring places. And so this is a tabletop, a small switchboard that would have been used maybe at a small hotel or a place that had five phone lines. And I received that from a museum in Warner, New Hampshire. So I found 50 or 60 telephone museums throughout the country. A lot of them have very limited hours and are run by volunteers, but they're an archive of old telephones and switchboards, usually passed along from the family who ran the town's phone lines. Mm-hmm. And so I struck up a conversation with one of them, and at first they were a little confused, so I sent a video of the prototype I made, and then they said, oh, okay, I get what you're doing. And so they invited me to come on over, and they donated a couple of switchboards to my project.
Great. And so how do you use them now? Just in a basic way, how do they function within your overall sort of setup?
So I take the original circuitry out so that I'm just left with the interface.
Uh-huh.
They have some pretty complex TRS jacks where when you plug in something a couple of contacts open and a couple of contacts close. So you can send audio, but you can also use a, you know, send a switch, an on and off signal to something else. Mm-hmm. And that's why I can, you can turn the lights. So there's an excessive amount of indicator lights, which make it also kind of a chandelier sculpture, mm-hmm. when you're surrounded by them. Mm. And I build the synthesizer circuits from kits, or I modify existing synths, or sometimes even toys. But favorites have been LB Designs. Their website has a lot of kits for building. It's basic parts of a modular and extension. So, mm-hmm. you know, oscillators, filters, sample and hold, ring mod, etc. Music from outer space. I built two sequencers, two 10-step sequencers, because the rows of numbers are arranged in 10, so I thought that really fit. And plus, having unusual numbers so that you can create phrases, periodic phrases that aren't necessarily bound to fours and eights standards, is really good.
So all this kind of circuit building and, you know, all the building that you're doing, I mean, this is something that you sort of, I guess you were already doing something like that in your audio, your installation, your visual, mm-hmm. but I guess ITP was an environment where you learned more of these kind of maker type of mm-hmm. skills and so on?
Yes, so I went there because I wanted to learn electricity. It was magic. I wanted to, mm-hmm. you know, create art that had a life to it, you know, a life in time. So durational light installations inspired by Dan Flavin or Olafur Eliasson, especially Olafur Eliasson, mm-hmm. where, you know, he really times the shifting of lights in a way that changes your body, and it takes you to a desert where the sun is setting. You know, it really mm-hmm. is very physical what he does with time. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to learn electronics so that I could work with time more as well.
So that's what you went into it.
Yes, thinking. That's what I went into it.
And for a time you were doing that, right?
Mm-hmm.
These
odd,
I
was
the
doing
kind of odd, installation
yeah.
you described sounds something like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
I see. So that seems like that was a really good environment, as it has been for a lot of people in New York who come through ITP to really kind of get some of these, to make some of these connections and develop some of these skills.
Yeah, it's really interesting that, you know, the first year I was overwhelmed in a good way with all of the things that you can learn there and all of the new people that you meet. But the actual idea came in the summer in between, far from there, more close to my roots because I'm from the Midwest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I really love that I was able to be in a quieter space and, you know, have a chance to go back to ITP and then really know what I wanted to do with it, mm-hmm. with 1 year left.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, great. Well, it's great. So let's just expand a little bit of a tour. So you've got the phone part of it, but then there's a lot of other stuff. Obviously, some of it right out of the box, right,
mm-hmm.
from different manufacturers, but then there's also some new stuff that you're working with. You have some new relationship with Moog, right? Or some project with Moog, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a whole hodgepodge, I guess, a mix of some of which you made, some that you're into, you know, that are talking to other things and so on. So I guess we don't have to do a complete tour here, but I guess you have some sequencers, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have some. So tell us a little about the Moog circuits. I guess that seems like a good because you're really using them for the first time, or they're
mm-hmm.
new in your project. So tell us about those.
Right. So Moog invited me to modify some of their circuits, and so they sent me some. They have a synth kit called a Workstat. So they sent two of them and some pedals. And where I'm at in the process is typically if I'm going to modify something, I want to kind of use it and get familiar with it as it is. And then I'll start building controllers for it. So I built expression pedal controllers since I like to manipulate music with my hands, and typically expression pedals come in a rocker,
right,
like a wah pedal.
But expression pedals being, you know, continuous data that you can direct to some end, whether
yes.
it's a filter or a volume or a pitch or, mm-hmm. or other.
Right. And so, and then here's a joystick from, originally it was a Dragon 32 system.
Dragon.
Anyone ever hear of that? I don't think so.
Ranjit, you know about that?
I got it at the ham radio fair at the New York Hall of Science, where they have a little, every summer they have like something called the Hozark Ham Radio Fair, where they set up a bunch of ham radio enthusiasts all get together and sell things.
So this is a ham radio part? Is that what you're saying?
It was a joystick that they were selling. Yeah, they just sell junk.
But what would it have been made for at the time?
For a video game system called Dragon 32 that failed.
It was a video game joystick. Okay,
yeah.
Got it. So you've adapted that to these Moog circuits or
Yeah, because I've been just thinking more about, you know, having what kind of interface do I want to use when I perform. So these are really unfinished, just the process of me learning how these things work and starting to add controllers to them, but eventually they'll be inside a switchboard, and I would probably assume that I'm going to make these into patch bays that are a little bit easier to modify in real time, because mm-hmm. those are guitar pedals. But I think it's just when you're playing live or even creating something in the studio, the faster that you can switch things around to try new ideas, the better. And mm-hmm. so these are thoughts that are coming to mind now that I do have a little bit more performance experience. I use a sampler I often do in live sets because they're all the sounds that I've created. Mm-hmm. I really like to come up with drum rhythms that aren't really out of drum machines.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just
clicks and pops. And
yeah, that. Just use synthesizers mm-hmm. as drum machines, mm-hmm. and that was another thing that the Buchla at NYU was really lent itself well to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so
well, it's
I'll
a very sequencer kind of driven machine, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the idea, right? Just
right, and then you just get all these nuances between the beats and. And then you can create your own swing without having to make a swing setting just by changing the length of the attack of everything. So mm-hmm. it's a really organic drum machine.
The Buchla,
well,
or
analog synths. In right. general. And that was an amazing thing to me, because in the past, you know, when I didn't know anything, I just thought there's synthesizers make music and drum machines make drums, because that's what they're called, and didn't really know any of this, so all of it's...
Well, aren't a lot of the really classic drum machines that are, you know, that everyone adores at this point, historical drum machines or otherwise, aren't they, most of them, ultimately synthesizers? I mean, the ones that are
yeah.
sample-based drum machines, nobody's really too excited about those, right? I mean, the one like the TR-606, right?
That's a
synthesizer,
mm-hmm.
right? All the
yeah.
sounds are synthesized.
Right, and I didn't
electronic sounds.
I didn't really know that before.
Right. So. I mean, they were designed to sound like drums.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't, I guess at that time, maybe this idea of this aesthetic was not, you know, or at least it wasn't a commercially viable aesthetic, but that's what they are, right?
Mm-hmm.
And most of the, so I understand. So that's you're doing a lot of rhythm stuff, right? And
mm-hmm.
well, let's talk about a little bit. So that's a lot of, more or less, a lot of technical and technology related stuff. But what about music and sound and aesthetics? I mean, what are your musical sonic inspirations, or you know, where are you coming from? Or what drives you?
That's a giant question.
Well,
so
what's your
favorite
record?
Coming, yeah, that's a giant question. But you know, I think I'm informed by being a DJ and vinyl collector for a really long time in the realms of techno, electro, IDM,
mm-hmm.
But also just sound walks that I've gone on that I mm. wasn't really even aware were sound walks. I was actually just thinking about this today, is that when I lived in Chicago, I went to on a tour at Fermilab, which is a physics laboratory where they take you around to the particle accelerator and tell you about how it works. But they also do tours of the campus. They created basically an Illinois prairie that they will walk you around. And the volunteer conducting the tour encouraged us all to close our eyes. And so hearing the sound world as we were walking through it, walking forward, and hearing just kind of an almost claustrophobic buzzing and worrying and you know, almost feeling the sound of the heat on you was really quite powerful with your eyes closed. And as we continued forward, all of a sudden you felt like you were in a church, like you could hear a really audible difference, and we were in a forest. So she purposely had us close our eyes to experience the really distinct characteristics of the prairie versus the forest and the resonant, the reverberation there. And so these are the types of things that inspire me. Living in a flight path near Meeker, where with the constant sort of white noise ocean whir of cars going by,
So the soundscape, really, and deep listening.
That inspires me.
Okay. So wonderful. Well, great. Well, so what are you? So what is all this? So tonight you're kind of going to perform some, you know, sort of a something in development, right?
Yes.
Or a work in progress, shall we say? Right? And this is all, in at least in the short term, this is heading towards a performance presentation at Moog Fest. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is kind of where you're headed with that, which will be in May. Is that right? Where is it headed? I mean, what's going to happen tonight, for example?
Tonight I'm going to play some sounds that are still very new in development, and I will try not to create any screeching feedback. But it did happen a few times in the sound check, but I will. I think I've gotten it at bay.
Good, and that would just be the result of circuits going to the wrong place or something.
Right. Just I'm still starting to become familiar. It's an interesting experiment. So here I am, giving these things a try in public to an audience. So thank you very much for being present with me. I'll be playing some process field recordings. So if you hear any little patters of telecom related sounds, that's kind of the phone museum aspect of it. And the rest, I think, will hopefully speak for itself.
Okay. And you're doing, and you have, so you're doing some DJ stuff pretty regularly in New York, right? You have something tomorrow, right?
Yep.
Where is that, or?
It is an undisclosed location, unless you RSVP. But
somewhere,
join my Facebook
somewhere in New
fan
York
page, right? Yes.
You're DJing, and you have any other things that you can tell us about coming up for you? I mean, that we might want to, I guess we can just check you out on Facebook or wherever.
Yeah, you know, follow my page. I always update what I'm doing, and I'll be I won't be performing live very often. I have another one, another set scheduled in March, so more info will come out about that. But I'm going to be kind of in a cave working on constructing new synths and working on producing tracks for future records, mostly this winter.
Right. I want to ask you about that, actually. So you had you released a record recently, I guess a 12-inch,
yep.
Right? An EP, right? And so that was your first, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Debut.
And what's the title? It's under the name Antennas, right?
Right.
And who put it out?
Ron Morelli from the label Lies.
Lies. And where is that? Is that in the US?
It's a Brooklyn. It's a Brooklyn-based label. Yeah.
So where would we find the record? Is it around, or is it sold out?
Friends of mine bought it at Heaven Street, which I think is closed for a little bit. Someone else I know found it at Rough Trade.
So it's out there.
Yeah, it's out there.
It's still around.
And you can look it up on Discogs or any online record store.
I've seen it online. I'm just wondering where the actual. It wasn't clear where I was, but so that's where you would find it.
Mm-hmm.
And you have any other records that you're working on or that are kind of in the works? Or
I have records in the works.
In the works. Yeah. Great. So following you at Antennas is your main.
Yep, and I have a SoundCloud as well.
Okay. All right. Well, so we're going to do, we're going to take a little break to change the lights. It's going to get very dark, right?
And in more ways than one.
Right. And it'll be what, like a half an hour, 45 minute set?
Probably
continuous
half an
set?
Hour.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you for being here.
So we'll take a little break.
And that was my conversation with electronic artist Lori Napoleon, a.k.a. Antennas. The evening continued with a live performance of a new work in progress that she's developing for her appearance later this year at Moog Fest. But we'll continue our program with a couple of tracks from her recent Antennas EP, The Track of the Storm, released in 2015 on the Brooklyn-based LIES label. Here's the title track. Thank you. That was Saint Antoine by Antennas from her 2015 EP, The Track of the Storm. We'll close out this month's program with an excerpt from a recent live ambient set by Laurie Napoleon, a.k.a. Antennas. You've been listening to the Musical Ecologies Radio Hour. For more information, visit our website at musicalecologies.net.